A very good morning to you all, and I'd like to just direct your attention once again to the two screens, just to every once in a while get everyone acclimated to where we are. As you see from the screen, we are celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation that occurred in Germany through the first leadership of Martin Luther, and then it spread through many personalities and also many writings throughout all of Europe. At that time, Luther lived in what was known as the Holy Roman Empire, and today that would be about the size of the current country of Germany. So that gives you some idea of where this was taking place. There are many who still don't understand the relationship between a revival and a reformation, or the differences between the two. We will be coming in the future, before we close out this series, on that. Well, it was on October the 31st, All Saints' Eve, All Halloween, that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. They were written in Latin so that a discussion could ensue about the things that were disturbing Luther, about the German Dominican friar Tetzel, who was right across the border selling indulgences to spring aunts and uncles and parents and children out of purgatory. This is what ultimately led to Luther posting those 95 theses, but instead of just limiting it to discussion among the academics at the University of Wittenberg, where Luther was teaching, instead a man got a copy of them, translated them into German, the vernacular of the people, and then spread those very widely across the region, which then began the process of moving in the direction that we have been going over the last 10 lectures in here. Now, I know that some of this is quite confusing. If we don't understand the Holy Roman Empire, if we don't understand the Middle Ages, and that we're coming to the end of the Middle Ages, and that many of the people that we know about, like Francis of Assisi, he's already lived and died, and many of the cathedrals are now Catholic only across Europe. The Protestant Reformation did not happen. The Pope has been in vogue since the very beginning, and there have been wars, there have been crusades. Many of them came out of Venice, as Venice was a known shipbuilding enterprise city, and there were many thousands of lives already lost fighting against the Muslims. And there are so many things that have happened in human history that it is quite difficult to track and trace everything that happened. I've always said, for me personally, that the best way to address any particular century is to read on several levels, beginning at the first of a century and then reading through to the end of that century. For instance, if you wanted to know about American history in the 19th century, you may well start with the Civil War, or you may begin with Carl Sandburg's six-volume set, his masterpiece on Abraham Lincoln. And you may then get so many ideas about the Civil War. Well, it's been determined that if you read these specific 100 books on the Civil War about artillery, about naval operations, about the uniforms, about the music, about strategy and tactics militarily, and you begin to read the biographies of Robert E. Lee and George Meade and all these other people, that after a while you would know. If you read and mastered those 100 books, you would know just about everything you need to know about the Civil War. But then, if you wanted to know more about slavery, then you would need to read other books on that. and politics and so forth, until finally, reading literature as well of the period, you would begin to fill in the blanks of a century and get a real sense of what was happening. So that would prevent anyone from getting things out of place in history and going to times where it would be inappropriate, for instance, for someone to go back to the first century and think of Jesus pulling out a timepiece of any kind made in Switzerland to determine what time of day it was. And so what we're seeking to do here is not to cover every aspect of the Reformation, but we're seeking to look at the Reformation through, first, the life of the man whom God used to bring it to pass, and then from whom it spread to Zwingli and Zurich, Switzerland, to John Calvin in Geneva, and to Melanchthon, who was right there with Luther at the University of Wittenberg in his 20s and already one of the most learned men in the world, especially in the biblical languages, Greek and Hebrew. So I want you to relax with me a bit because there's some intensity to all that we have been presenting so far. Here's the thing that all of you would know if you have been in here during these last 10 lectures. You have, first of all, a foundation for what caused the Reformation in the sale of indulgences by Tetzel. Last week, we came to the death of Tetzel, who really died in despair after he was confronted by one of the Roman legates because of what he had done in setting in motion the works and the writings and the disputations with Martin Luther. So here we have something that's occurring, and we've already passed the 100-year mark. We went from 1517, when Martin Luther nailed the theses to the wall. We've already passed now into 1518, and we saw that with the Diet of Augsburg and the Augsburg interrogation. And today we're moving into one of the most important disputations, but it is so vast that I decided that it has to be broken into two parts. You have to know the people here that are involved in this disputation. You need to know where it is and why it was where it was. Instead of me just coming before you and saying, let's get into the issues of the Diet of Leipzig. So today, I would say, is introductory and preliminary to the content of the disputation, which, Lord willing, we will look at next week. If it gets too tedious for you, it's not my intent to do that. I'm hoping that there are a majority in here who would not like to just float over the surface of everything, but who would really like a deeper understanding. For instance, if we were to come into the room like we have this morning and then leave and go to lunch and begin to talk about this group that meets in the ministry center at 9 o'clock to study the life of Luther and the Protestant Reformation, I would think that there would be so many various conversations going on that you would talk about the clothes that people are wearing, how many people in here wear eyeglasses, how many people felt that the temperature in the room was just right. Some engineers might say, well, if asked, I think the dimensions of the room would be this, about this long and about this wide. Some techies would say, well, the sound system sounded okay and the projection unit sounded pretty well and the prayer requests are on the table in front of you, etc. But there would be so many things to talk about other than just talking about the substance of the lecture. Now, in small group theory and analysis, we call this, let me describe it first. Someone sitting up on a ledge in the corner above the screen and looking out, and they're looking at everything but the content, and that person then is looking at the dynamics of the room, the speech going on, the movements, those that have coffee and sweets and those who don't, and it would be taking in all the dynamics of what is going on in the room. That's what I'm trying to do today with you, to give you a sense of the diet at Leipzig, and to help you understand what was going on. I think that you'll enjoy it, and I think that with this, and you're coming next week if you're able, I think you will, for the first time maybe in your life, if you've never heard a lecture or read much about Leipzig, that this would be an underpinning to really help you with your knowledge and your understanding. And of course, my last comment before we introduce today is that I don't think any of this is wasted as frivolous knowledge. I think that as we begin to continue to grow in our understanding, that what's at stake here is our own eternal life and what we actually believe about the contents of the 66 books of the Old and the New Testament. With that, let me begin. Part 11. After Miltie's visit, and I need to stop there because I made a mistake last week. I put an extra I in there because one of the books had it, and I went back to relook at that, and I had to change everything. It's not M-I-L-I-T, and I did hear a German pronunciation, and so let's go from what I did say, and I won't repeat that so you don't get confused. This is Miltie's. That's the way the Germans pronounce it. So after Miltie's visit with Luther for 3 days on January 4, 5, and 6 of 1519, we're just past the one-year mark of the 95 Theses, his meeting with Spalatin, Luther's friend, and remember Spalatin is the one who said when Miltie's came after him about Luther, Spalatin turned the tables, an apologetic term, and came after Miltie's and said, it's your guy, Tetzel, who started all this by selling indulgences right across the borders, and this is what Luther responded to. Well, Miltie's, therefore, got so upset that Tetzel had done this that he turned away from Spalatin and he turned towards Tetzel. And this is what this is all about, his subsequent confrontation with Tetzel, because he said, I want to see you. Tetzel said, I'm afraid for my life. I will not meet with you. And Miltie's went to him anyway, where he was hiding out. And they had a conversation. And Tetzel fell into despair. And it wasn't long after that he died. And some have suggested of a broken heart. So after these events, the scholastic professor at Ingolstadt University, a man that we're going to examine quite carefully today, John Eck, renewed the battle against the reformer. So he's already had these three men from the Vatican in Rome to come after Luther, getting him to do one thing, to recant. Tell the Pope you're sorry. Tell the church you're sorry. Don't divide this church. And Luther, of course, says, I cannot say the Latin word revoco, I recant, because it's against my conscience and it's against the very word of God. Eck was formerly Luther's friend, and he was a strong supporter of the papacy and longed to have a disputation with Luther, and you'll see why he longed to have that in just a moment. After writing his theses against Luther's doctrine, Luther was deeply moved and felt that he could not neglect or avoid honorably John Eck. Soon the relationship became antagonistic, and Eck made the first move to suggest to the Duke George, a disputation in Leipzig. Our task today is to introduce the Leipzig disputation and prepare you for investigating the issues that arose in this 20-day debate. in the summer of 1519. So now, once again, as I try to keep you posted on timelines and people, this is about a year and a half or a little bit more after the nailing of the 95 Theses. That's how far we are into the process of the Reformation. I want you to walk with me through some of the details of the life of John Eck. If someone is a friend and then they have this big passion, this growing inside, I've got to get to this man, Luther, you have to ask the question, why? Eck, what's inside of you that wants you to bring down this man? What is it inside of you that's driving you to do everything in your power to get him in front of you in a big debate that would have ripples all across Europe? Well, you're going to see, and you're going to see one of the best short portraits of this man that has been provided in church history. But first of all, notice the dates that he lived and died. He was born in 1486, and do you remember when Luther was born? 1483. So Luther is only 3 years older than him. And notice this. He died in 1543. Luther died in 1546. So you really have contemporaries, real contemporaries here, that are going to be meeting one another. Well, he was actually born Johann Meyer, and that can be spelled M-E as well as M-A-I-E-R. But he was born at a city named Eck, and he's the one that changed his name, as they did sometimes in those days, to the location where they were born. So he became known as John Eck. Today, you would not find Eck on the map. You would find egg, as in a raw egg, one that you eat. In southeast Germany, and became known, as I said, as Johann Eck. And though he had been Luther's friend, note this, that not only does he become an enemy, but he's the first German opponent. The other opponents, Prierius and the others who came over to dispute with him and meet with him, were all Italian. So this is an interesting debate that's about to take place because they're both of German blood. He had a very forceful public personality, and Roland Bainton, who in 1950 wrote the best biography on the life of Luther, which still stands in the annals of time about his life, wrote, despite his butcher's face and bull's voice, he was a man of prodigious memory, torrential fluency, and uncanny acumen. That's a brief summary, but there are more words to come to describe him. But first, know that in Munich's Hall of Fame, that John Eck made it in there as a small statuary, a bust of his head, which is on the right. And there you see the Hall of Fame of those people who had grown up in Saxony and made an impact in the world. I decided to try to help you a bit with John Eck and geography before we go into more of his profile. And if we look at the map and begin on the left-hand side, down at the bottom, you'll see, number one, that he was born in Eck near Memmingen in Swabia on November the 13th of 86. And that's just an hour from Augsburg, but let's locate that. And then would you go north in your mind's eye only? There's no directive there for you. But do you remember the map that I gave you where Luther had all of his upbringing and education? It was up to the north of there where you see Eisleben and Mansfeld, Eisenach, and so forth. And then over to Wittenberg, where he went into the Augustinian monastery and then became a professor of theology right there. So what we're seeing is that Germany, with these two men, are divided into two locations where their influence was gained and their education taken. And it's interesting that, as we see in our own country, sometimes we're segmented by geographical location. And so it's not uncommon for us to hear about the bookends of the West Coast and the East Coast in political controversy, and then Middle America, and we hear things like Middle America values. Well, here, the part where Luther was born was the more conservative part, and down in the South, Catholicism was extremely strong, and Eck was steeped in that, along with the various cities where he took his education. Let's move up on the left-hand side. His early education was in Rottenburg. Doesn't even show up on the map, but that's the approximate location. And it was his own uncle, who was a Catholic priest, who educated him in his early, what we would call, elementary education. You have to skip to the top. He then went to the University of Heidelberg, and there he only spent 1 year and desired to go to another place, and that was number four, Tübingen, where he received his degree. Now, how bright was he? He actually went to the University of Heidelberg when he was 12 years old. So now he's at Tübingen, and he finishes his master's degree in 1501. Luther at this point is 18 years old, and he's studying there. And then we come to the right side to Freiburg University, where he began to study theology. And then it's off the map, or I would have put it. He went to Strasbourg, which is not France, but Germany and the Holy Roman Empire in that day. And there he studied until he received his doctor of theology degree. It was after that, in 1510, that he was called as professor at Ingolstadt University. And there you see that is south of Nuremberg, for those of you that have been there perhaps in your travels, and then a little bit northeast of Augsburg, where we saw the Augsburg interrogation last week. So that's a little bit about the geography. And while we're here, would you look at that last one, number six, and let your eye from the arrow itself, from the point of the arrow, go straight north almost without interruption, and you'll see the city of Leipzig. And that's where the disputation is going to take place. And you see for Luther coming out of Wittenberg, it's going to be a much shorter trip than it was for John Eck. I've mentioned this author before. After doing all my research for years, I actually, over and over again, go back to a volume that I actually purchased when I was 25 years old. And the way to pronounce this man's name one more time is D'Aubigny. He's a French church historian, wrote this marvelous, thick book on the Reformation. It is only for those who would like exquisite detail about conversations, writings, Latin quotes, and the like. I have found none better than D'Aubigny to give a portrait of John Eck. And that's what I was seeking out for me and for you this week. Who would tell us really what this man was like? Because if Luther's going to face him, he has to know what he's like, and Eck has to know what Luther's like and where their weaknesses and strengths are going to be. But I think this says it all. Eck was sincerely attached to the papacy, but seems to have had no true religious sentiments, and to have been one of that class of men so numerous in every age, who look upon science and even theology and religion as the means of acquiring worldly reputation. Vainglory, spelled separately in this quote, but we would use it as one word, lies hid under the priest's cassock, no less than under the warrior's coat of mail. Eck had studied the art of disputation according to the rules of the schoolmen. Those were the scholastics who studied Aristotle and the Greek philosophers and had become a master in this sort of controversy. While the knights of the Middle Ages and the warriors in the time of the Reformation sought for glory in the tournament, the schoolmen struggled for it in syllogistic disputations, a spectacle of frequent occurrence in the universities. In fact, most of the universities were studying the scholastics and humanism, like the humanism of Erasmus of Rotterdam, but not of the Bible itself. Let me stop here for a moment and tell you about a discussion I had with a Jewish rabbi many years ago now. It was in a friend's home, and I sat at the head of the table. There were others at the table for dinner. He sat on my immediate left. And as we began to talk about Christianity and Judaism, I began to sense something as I cited a particular passage. And he very soon then let me know that he had never in his entire life even read the New Testament. So what I want to bring to your attention is it would not have been uncommon in this time for someone to read more about Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and other humanists than they would their own Bible. Eck, who entertained no mean, and that doesn't mean mad or being a mean person, but he had no low opinion of himself. In fact, he had a very high opinion of himself, and who was proud of his talents, of the popularity of his cause, and of the victories he had gained in 8 universities of Hungary, Lombardy, and Germany, ardently desired to have an opportunity of trying his strength and skill against the reformer. He had spared no exertion to acquire the reputation of being one of the most learned men of the age. He would have been up there, though not quite as high, as the top scholar of this period, namely, again, Erasmus of Rotterdam. He was constantly endeavoring to excite some new discussion, to make a sensation, and aimed at procuring, by means of his exploits, all the enjoyments of life. A journey that he had made to Italy had been, according to his own count, one long series of triumphs. The most learned scholars had been forced to subscribe to his theses. This experienced gladiator fixed his eyes on a new field of battle in which he thought the victory already lay secure. Now, what does Eck have in his mind? And I'll give this away just a little bit for next week. He thinks Martin Luther is a poor, shabbily clothed, inferior Wittenberg professor theologian. He has no idea of the expansiveness of the mind of Martin Luther. He has no idea that no one of this time knows the Bible, as we would say today, backwards and forwards like Martin Luther. But not only that, the church fathers. I have the church fathers in my library. These are those who lived in the first 300 to 500 years. Names like Origen, Tertullian, St. Augustine. And he knew so many of these passages from the fathers by heart that he had all these arguments that he had built up inside of him. And so when Eck first stands up at the debate, he really believes that this is going to be a time to make, again, as we would say in our day, to make mincemeat of this little friar who really will not be much. And so Eck, with his desire to triumph over the friar and to be hailed in Rome as the great conqueror and the one who finally put down the Reformation, he's coming after Luther and he's looking to get his claws against his throat and to forever dismantle what has been happening for the last year and a half. I think that's a fair way to say this. Eck's desire to conquer Luther. Eck published 13 theses against the doctrines espoused by Luther. So that's how many of these disputations started. He got Luther's writings, and then he published 13 of his own theses. And the 13th thesis says this: we deny that the Roman Church was not raised above the other churches before the time of Pope Sylvester, and we acknowledge in every age, as the successor of St. Peter and the vicar of Jesus Christ, him who has filled the chair and held the faith of St. Peter. Now, because of the negative dimensions in the first part of this paragraph, let's read it in a different way. Let's first of all remove the words "we deny." The Roman Church was not raised above other churches before the time of Pope Sylvester. But he says, we deny that. So in other words, he believes that the Pope was sitting on an infallible throne from St. Peter on. This is the argument, the very first one that will be made at the Leipzig debate, and Luther and him will spar over that among other topics that we'll look at next week. Sylvester lived during the time of Constantine the Great. By this thesis, Eck denied that the primacy enjoyed by Rome had been conferred on it by that emperor. And that's what Luther was trying to say. Look, this all started under Constantine, not from the earliest church fathers. Luther's response to Eck. I love this about Luther. I have to tell you, I'm strengthened in my own faith every day by a man who refuses to back down and only speaks what his conscience allows him to speak and what he truly believes. Luther writes, "Let it be understood that when I say the authority of the Roman pontiff rests on a human, not a divine decree, I am not counseling disobedience." You see this over and over again, a humility and a desire to reform the church and not to split the church. But we cannot admit, and let me ask you, what's in your heart as you hear the words of Luther this morning? We cannot admit that all the sheep of Christ were committed to Peter. What then was given to Paul? When Christ said to Peter, "Feed my sheep," he did not mean, did he, that no one else can feed them without Peter's permission? Nor can I agree that the Roman pontiffs cannot err or that they alone can interpret Scripture. The papal decretal by a new grammar turns the words of Christ, "Thou art Peter," into "Thou art the primate." By the decretals, the gospel is extinguished. I can hardly restrain myself against the most impious and perverse blasphemy of this decretal. Now, let me introduce the Leipzig debate, and we'll come back to that topic next week as we look at the contents of the debate. Eck approached the patron of Leipzig, who was Duke George, and he was called the Bearded to distinguish him from other rulers that had come along, and he asked him to consider setting up a debate. Well, the Duke agreed that Eck should debate, but not Luther. He didn't want all this turmoil coming into his region of government, and so he said the debate needed to be with Andrew Karlstad at Leipzig, not with Luther. Now, Karlstad, remember, was the professor at Wittenberg who was the overseer of Martin Luther's doctoral degree at the University of Wittenberg. But even Karlstad, as he saw Luther's skill and knowledge more and more, he always knew that he was inferior, and he's the one that said, "No one knows the Bible like Martin Luther." However, Eck had no mind to fence with the second. That is, the second in line. He wanted Luther, and he openly baited Luther. So the debate was scheduled for June 27th through July 16th, but with Karlstad against Eck. And Karlstad doesn't want that. Eck is up for the challenge. He's a very knowledgeable man as well. But Luther first responds to Eck's theses. "This man calls Karlstad his antagonist, and at the same time attacks me. So you see the plan that Eck has. It looks like he's going after Kahlstad because of what Duke George said, but in reality, he still wants Luther between his teeth. But God reigns. He knows what he will bring out of this tragedy. He may not know, really. It is neither Dr. Eck nor myself that will be at stake. God's purpose will be accomplished. Thanks to Eck, this affair, which hitherto has been mere play, after a year and a half, it will become serious and inflict a deadly blow on the tyranny of Rome and of the Roman pontiff. Now, he's writing and giving other responses too. So he writes to the elector. Now, Dr. Eck attacks me, and not only me, but the University of Wittenberg also. He makes light of the university. It's not a very reputable university. It is quite young. It was only started around 1501 or 2 under Frederick the Wise. And it's growing in its reputation, but Ingolstadt has already been established for many years, and so he feels that he's looking down on this youthful university, and he's attacking all the professors there, like Kahlstad and others. And Melanchthon was at Wittenberg as well. I cannot suffer the truth to be thus covered with opprobrium, that is, with disgrace or shame, that Eck is making this into. This is my favorite. He writes directly to John Eck. Now, my dear Eck, be brave and gird thy sword upon thy thigh, thou mighty man. He's not afraid of a soul. If I cannot please thee as mediator, perhaps I shall please thee better as an antagonist. Not that I imagine I can vanquish thee, but because after all the triumphs thou hast gained in Hungary, Lombardy, and Bavaria, if at least we are to believe thee. Isn't that great? I shall give thee opportunity of gaining the title of conqueror of Saxony and Misnia, which is the German city of Meissen, where the Meissen clay comes for the pottery, the cradle of Saxony, so that thou shalt forever be hailed with the glorious title of August. Caesar Augustus, that's what he is referring to, that he wants to rule with his mighty mind over all of Europe. Well, Luther's friends were alarmed at the boldness of Luther, and Spalatin was filled with anxiety. He probably went on Prozac. And Frederick the Wise was uneasy because this was happening in his jurisdiction. Well, Luther continued with some responses to Duke George. Luther wrote letter after letter to Duke George, in whose states Leipzig was situated, asking him to give him permission to go and take part in the disputation. But George, being a firm Catholic and agreeing with almost everything that John Eck stood for, didn't want even there to be a chance that Luther might have a hand up. So Luther received absolutely no answer from Duke George about his request. Finally, it was clear through another writer back to Luther that he refused to let Luther take part in the debate. He would only allow him to come and sit, as it were, in the galleries to be a spectator. George believed, as Eck did, about the papacy, as I just said. There was much pressure to prevent the disputation by the bishop also of Merseburg and all the Leipzig theologians, but nothing could prevent the combat. And so, as Daubigny says, each man got his arms ready. Let's talk now about, let's just form the setting. As I was mentioning earlier about all the details of what is called a process observer. That's the little man sitting up in the corner looking down and looking at everything but content. What are you seeing? What is happening? if you had been there, what would you have witnessed with your own eyes and heard with your own ears? Well, the debate, as I said, started on the 27th of June, 6 days earlier, on the 21st, Eck, traveling north, enters the city of Leipzig, robed in his sacerdotal garments, and he's at the head of this very large procession who has come up with him to watch Martin Luther's ultimate and final defeat. On the 24th, 3 days later, Karlstadt arrived from Wittenberg in his carriage, and behind him in the next carriage were Martin Luther on one side and Melanchthon on the other. And were these ever two close friends? Melanchthon really was a tremendous help and encourager in the Reformation. Well, the wheel of Karlstadt's carriage fell off and threw him unhurt to the ground. And those who saw it, who were on the side of Eck, said, "There it is. There's God's sign that Luther will be cast down into the mud and Eck will triumph over him." Well, there was an arrival fanfare. Eck was known at that time as the Goliath of the Philistines, coming against young David Luther with a slingshot and some smooth stones. So the Goliath of the Philistines came first and walked in the Corpus Christi, that is the body of Christ, procession that was being held in Leipzig. And this celebrates the real presence of the body and blood of Christ in the sacrament, in the Mass, and we know that today and then as transubstantiation. And that's why for so long that the parishioners of Catholic churches around the world, you would know this in your own day, some of you, that the cup was never given to the people, only to the priest. So the people could only take the wafer. And even then, as I learned in seminary from a very eminent church historian that I had as professor, he said they used to consider what would happen if they accidentally dropped a wafer on the floor and a rat ate it. So the question was, what happens to the consecrated bread, the Lord's body, when a rat eats it because it's converted into the actual body of Jesus Christ? That's what transubstantiation is. And we're going to look at this more before the end of our series, but let me go over that one more time in case this is new, even to one person in the room. So when communion is being taken and the wafer placed on the tongue, the moment you eat it and swallow it, that wafer, whatever it's made of, since it's been consecrated by the priest in the Mass, it literally turns, is converted into the body of Jesus Christ. Then later, when the laity could take the cup, the wine or the grape juice would literally turn into the actual blood of Jesus Christ. This is one of the things that Martin Luther is going to oppose in one of his four powerful documents that he wrote on the sacraments, and it has to do with the Babylonian captivity of the church. So this was transubstantiation, and just to look far out a little bit, Luther came back with consubstantiation, that Jesus' body and blood were not literally converted into the body and blood of Christ, but rather that Jesus was in, under, and around the elements in a mystical, spiritual sense. He was provided by the town council, can you imagine this, with a bodyguard of 76 men to protect him day and night. But Luther was perhaps no less worried about being, he'd already been threatened to be bound hand and foot. And so Luther, Karlstadt, and Melanchthon and the other doctors arriving from Wittenberg had 200 students from the university armed with battle axes. Has much changed in the history of the world? I'm going to show you a picture of where the debate took place, but this is a modern building compared to then. You see the name at the bottom, the Pleissenburg Palace. This was the site of the Leipzig debate. It was, of course, over time destroyed, and a competition was put out. And so the architect who could most copy the dome of the old Pleissenburg Palace was given this to draw up himself. And so this is the new town hall, what you would see today in Leipzig. Well, as soon as Luther then gets into town, Eck, who's been there 3 days, immediately has to see Luther. So he goes to visit him. Eck, what is this? I'm told that you refuse to dispute with me. Luther, how can I, since the Duke has forbidden me? Eck, if I cannot dispute with you, I care little about meeting Karlstad. It was on of your account that I actually came here all the way from the south and made this long trip. So if I can procure you the Duke's permission, will you enter the list with me? That's a technical term. It's an English idiom, which means take part in a contest or argument. Will you debate me? Luther, I love this, joyfully. I think he probably said it kind of off the cuff. Sure. Procure it for me, and we will fight. Well, Eck went immediately to the Duke with assurances to him of his victory, because this is what the Duke was concerned about. What if Luther beats you? And Eck just says, I promise you, he won't. Let him debate me. On June the 25th, then, Eck and Luther met in the palace to hear the regulations. Well, first of all, the disputation hall inside the palace was prepared. It was a large hall, as we said, in the Pleissenburg Palace, and it was prepared for a specific, this one, a disputation. Two pulpits were erected opposite each other. Tables were placed for the notaries, or what we today might call a secretary, administrative assistant, commissioned to take down the discussion. They're going to record this. Tapestry-decorated chairs and benches were arranged around for spectators. And interestingly enough, a portrait of St. Martin, going all the way back to the beginning of our lectures, the saint for whom Martin was named as a baby, was suspended over Luther's pulpit, while a representation of St. George the Champion over X. Do you remember the story of St. George and the dragon? That's who was over X pulpit. Everything in the arrangement of the room announced the importance that was attached to this contest. And now, let me show you an old 19th century oil on linen painting of the Leipzig disputation. And that will give you an idea of how close in they were, but also some particular notations. First of all, Luther is on the right, and it's amazing how accurate a picture that is according to the drawings and the paintings of Lucas Cranach, who was Luther's painter and also Luther's wife and Melanchthon and many people of this age. That is a very good representation of Luther and also of John Eck, that bull of a man. You see, the pulpit stand had been constructed, and right in the middle, in his royal robe, would be the bearded one, Duke George, the bearded one. And then around him would be other royals. And then look on the bottom left, and you'll see a man there with his right hand having a quill or feather in it. He is taking notes. These were scribal desks, if you will. If you'll look over on the right, just below the pulpit of Luther, you'll see another man writing there. Of great interest here, we won't come back to it, but would you notice, go back to the left, bottom left, to that scribe, and look right in front of him. There is a court jester. You've heard the phrase before, who will tell the king that he's not wearing clothes? Well, it was the court jester, because he used comedy, but he also was very knowledgeable. He was not a fool in the sense of one who had no knowledge, but he was able to speak the truth, but he would do so in such a way that it would make the king or that high person really understand. So don't know that there was one there, but this artist drew a court jester into the painting. So that's one. I want to show you a second one. There you have Luther on the left and John Eck on the right. This is a better rendering of John Eck and a poorer rendering of Martin Luther. But there you see the same kind of idea with St. George, the bearded one, looking very much the same in all the pictures. And that young man beside him is only 12 years old, and he is in line to become the next Duke. So he's there learning in the midst of waiting for his own rule. And then, of course, on the front right, you see a man with an open book, probably yet another scribe. So those are two different pictures and depictions of the debate at Leipzig. Now, what were the regulations that were put to these two men? Both parties met, as we said, to hear the regulations that had to be obeyed, the same as we hear in our own presidential debates. You have X number of minutes, and you have X number of minutes to respond, and then you have X number of minutes, and you have X number of minutes to respond. Eck demanded that they would debate extemporaneously and that no one would, quote, take down our words in writing. From the very beginning, he wanted it squelched, and he wanted judges, and one of the judges he wanted to be the Pope, and others that were on his side to judge the outcome of the debate. And Luther said, in essence, no way. Well, Karlstadt got involved, and he reminded Eck that it has been agreed that the disputation should not only be written down, but reported, published, and submitted to the judgment, not just of a small group of judges, but to everyone across Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. And Eck was obliged to consent. Luther said, "Does then the truth of Dr. Eck and his followers dread the light?" There he goes again. He slips in the knife as if it were going into hot butter. I will say one other thing, that Luther had brought books. He had brought his Bible. He had brought books of the church fathers. And Eck demanded that everything be extemporaneous and from the memory, and that books could not be referred to. So everything then that Luther ultimately did came from his own incredible memory and mind. Reminders to Eck and Luther. A Greek and Hebrew scholar from the University of Leipzig, Peter Mosellanus, was personally asked by Duke George to open the Leipzig disputation and did so with an excellent address. This is very important, and I really love this man, and he was swayed some by Luther during the disputation. He says, "If you fall to quarreling, what difference will there be between a theologian in discussion and a shameless duelist?" Yes, that means someone who is going out with guns and doing a duel. Hamilton Burr. "What is your object in gaining the victory if it be not to recover a brother from the error of his ways? It appears to me that each of you should desire less to conquer than to be conquered." And so there was not to be any name calling, not any personal ad hominem attacks, no shaming, but to deal with the issues. If only that could happen today in American politics. You see to what a low level we have been subjected in this country, where people can no longer debate the merits of whether communism, socialism, capitalism, Marxism are really the best political system for the good of everyone. Hoskins wrote a book on civility and how we've lost it in America. And Guinness said, "Nothing is more precious and potent than truth. But nothing is more dangerous than to debate such arguments to the public in the public square. Before long, the different sides will go for the jugular, and verbal violence will issue in conflicts that are as ugly as they are insoluble. Would to God, as a parenthesis here, that we would return to the days when we would see in our own televisions and in the public square people really giving very intellectual answers to the issues that confront us in our own land as well as those across the world. Here's an example of how Eck failed at this during the debate at Leipzig. Eck, at one point, the Reverend Father is a very poor cook. Do you see the ad hominem attack? He has made a terrible hodgepodge of Greek saints and heretics so that the odor of sanctity in the one prevents us from smelling the poison of the others. Luther retorted, "The worthy doctor is becoming abusive. In my opinion, there can be no communion between Christ and Belial." So we see this in the middle of the Leipzig debate, and it's brought back to dignity to argue on the merits. I will say this, that by the end of the 20-day debate, Eck is really shocked at what he's faced in Martin Luther. This, as many will say, is just like Julius Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon. This debate is the crossing of the Rubicon for the Protestant Reformation. What can we know about the disputation? And again, I've just taken that clip or that picture out for the scribe. The proceedings of the Leipzig disputation was recorded by four different people. The documentation, as indicated by many, is abundant. Now, I think you would like to hear descriptions of the two men, three men really, but Moscellanus' descriptions, the one who opened the Leipzig debate, said this about Luther. "Martin Luther is of middle stature and so thin in consequence of his studies that his bones may almost be counted." We tend to see Luther as a very robust man. Those are in his later years. He's quite thin here. He is in the prime of life. He's only 35 years of old at this time and has a clear and sonorous voice. His knowledge and understanding of the Holy Scriptures is unparalleled. He has the Word of God at his fingers' ends, we would say fingertips. Besides this, he possesses a great store of arguments and ideas. One might perhaps desire a little more judgment in arranging his subjects. In conversation, he is pleasing and affable. There is nothing harsh or austere about him. He can accommodate himself to everyone. His manner of speaking is agreeable and unembarrassed. He displays firmness and is always a cheerful air, whatever may be his adversary's threats, so that it is difficult to believe that he could undertake such great things without the divine protection. He is blamed, however, for being more caustic when reproving others than becomes a theologian, particularly when putting forward novelties in religion." In other words, he does go on the attack. Karlstadt is of shorter stature. His complexion is dark and sunburnt, his voice unpleasing, his memory less trustworthy than Luther's, and he is more inclined to anger. He possesses, however, though in a smaller degree, the qualities that distinguish his friend. And now Eck. Eck is tall, broad shoulders, and has a strong and thorough German voice. He has good lungs so that he would be heard well in a theater and would even make an excellent town crier. His accent is rather vulgar, that means common, than elegant. He is not that gracefulness so much extolled by Fabius, the Roman emperor of old, or Cicero, the one who has the golden mouth. His mouth, his eyes, and his whole countenance give you the idea of a soldier or a butcher rather than of a divine. He has an excellent memory, and if he had only as much understanding, he would really be a perfect man. But he is slow of comprehension and is wanting in judgment, without which all other qualities are useless. Hence, in disputing, he heaps together without selection or discernment a mass of passages from the Bible, quotations from the fathers, and proofs of all kings. He has besides an impudence, that is, shamelessness or disrespect, almost beyond conception. If he is embarrassed about anything that's said to him, he breaks off the subject he is treating of and plunges into another to escape it. He sometimes even takes up his adversary's opinion, clothing it in other words, and with extraordinary skill, attributes to his opponent the absurdity he has been himself defending. And I think what we see here is the character of Karlstad, and from beginning to end, that brief portrait by d'Aubigny to this one by a man who actually introduced the Leipzig debate, we see that Karlstad did, in fact, seem to have one thing in mind, winning and going back to Rome as Caesar Augustus, as it were, and defeating someone and being the hero against the German Reformation. So on June the 20th, So on June the 27th, was the opening day of the disputation. Next week, we will consider the details of this important debate and come to our own conclusions about which one of these two men won this important debate. Let's see how much time we have. We have about 12 minutes. If there are mics, we could take about 10 minutes of questions. And so if you have a question, let's do that, and then we can dismiss after that. Okay, who has the first question? There are a couple, one over here. Here they come. And Bob has one here.
You're a gentleman. I don't care. John, you mentioned a number of times, and you showed on the map, quite a number of universities in that area. Why is that? What was the size of them? What was the format by which they existed? It seems peculiar that at that time there were that many institutions of higher learning.
Well, if you go all the way back to Henry VIII, let's say, he was responsible for building the largest college at Oxford University, Christ Church College, and then you have these other colleges that are built after medieval queens and kings. And so as it happened in England, so it happened in Germany, and they had a real high view of scholastic learning. And Wittenberg, for instance, had about 200 students, but soon after this debate, it doubled in size to over 400. And some students actually left Leipzig and transferred to the University of Wittenberg just to be exposed to Karlstadt, Luther, and Melanchthon, among the other really knowledgeable men. So it was to educate the German class, and of course the poor, like here in America, didn't go to college, but those that had the ability and were trained usually by a parish priest in a Catholic church or a cathedral, those would be the one who had that early underpinning who then could go on to the university. And we remember Luther, don't we, whose father trained him early and then sent him off to be trained by an uncle, and then he went on to gradually go to different schools, Magdeburg and so forth, until finally he was prepared to go into the university and ultimately into law school. So, but they had to have means, too. Remember how Luther's father, as one case, had been a miner, and then he was one who leased mines and then had enough money to give Luther money to go to the bookstore to buy all these law books. So if you didn't have money, you really couldn't go to the university. So they were expanding all over. And again, by the time this disputation happened, Wittenberg was only about 17 years old.
We're okay, here, John.
Good question.
We're here.
Thank you, John. I know that the East and Western churches began to split 800 to 1054. When the Reformation did begin, what was happening in the Eastern Orthodox Church with respect to what was happening in the West? Or was it too soon for anything to occur as a result of the spillout?
Yes. They had already split, as you said correctly, and so the East never recognized the Italian Pope. They never recognized that St. Peter had been the first of a lineage of popes, and so they had their own hierarchy of leaders, and they differed on many matters, even the date of Christmas, for instance, where the West celebrates it on the 25th and the Eastern Orthodox celebrates it on the 6th. Both of the churches kept certain things together, like icons. The East have all of their icons, and the West, of course, we've seen that with Frederick the Great and Purgatory and all that. So there wasn't an influence yet in the Greek church from what's happening here. This is just a battle against Rome. Okay? Anything else?
Right here, Jerry.
Okay.
Perhaps more of a comment than a question, but I think it's interesting when you consider, is it Mausolanus? Is that how you pronounce his name? Mausolanus' description of Luther is
right.
That when you think of his countenance, there's humility. He has the capacity for critical thinking, and he has profound knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that in the context of his debate at that time and considering the debates of our time, how substantially different they are.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent comment. I long for that when I honestly am moving more and more away from TV news because of that very thing. And it's a sure cut off the power to the TV when four people are talking over one another. Because it only shows then that no one is really listening, and no one therefore can even consider the merits of someone's argument. It seems to me that what we've lost in the universities is the ability to reason. Reason is what has really suffered. Even if someone is wedded, like Eck was, to his own ideology and his own worldview, at least he had to stand there in the front of Duke George and listen and take it in. And even at the end of the debate, which we'll see next week, he was affected by it because Luther had landed intelligent punches about his own theory of when the papacy really started. It put doubts in his mind. And so when we have, let's say, a conversation with someone who's not a Christian and they believe in certain things that are anti-Christian, or they may be pro another religion or another philosophy, what we ought to do apologetically is at least be able to level an assault, not a passionate assault, but an assault on ideas, and to say that's just not true. I can't tell you how many times that I've spoken to people like that over the years, and I've just said, that sounds really good, but that is just not true, and it cannot be substantiated. In fact, it's the opposite of what you just said. And if you'll research it, you'll find that what I said is true. It's amazing how many things that people believe in strongly are absolutely untrue and categorically false. And we see that on the news. We see people who report things. And I'm actually, and I don't want to offend anybody here, but I'm actually right now for the term when it's accurate, fake news. when someone is making up something to get their own point across. And by the way, I'm not just speaking politically. I'm speaking in the realm primarily of Christianity, because you've got to make a choice. Is the Pope the head of the church today, or is he not? And if so, then where does the Greek Orthodox come in? And where do the Protestant churches fit in? I want to ask you a question, because I'm going to be very honest with you as we move more towards applications when I get back from Poland in those last 4 weeks, ending this series by the end of June. What is the gospel? And I didn't hear every word that Pope Francis spoke when he was here, but I listened to a lot. I wanted to hear. And all I can tell you, and someone can easily prove me wrong by telling me about it, but never once did I hear the gospel of Jesus Christ proclaimed by the Pope. But what I did hear was this open invitation for anyone who wanted to return to the Catholic Church. But I never heard a reason that anybody should. Just come home. We want to enlarge the Catholic Church. We want you to feel that no matter what you have done or do, that you can come back. And I think that it's hard work, actually, to build a solid worldview. It's hard work. It takes detailed work. It takes immense reading. It takes thinking. It takes discussing things with other people where we can learn and where we can be corrected as well as correct others. I think that's the thing that I miss more than anything in life right now, where it was said in the 19th century that you could even go into saloons in the Old West or in the universities of the United States and you could just sit down and have a theological discussion about something. But today, what's the rule? You don't talk about religion or politics. And so as a result of that, we're a much weaker nation in many respects in terms of values, in terms of ideas. And what we're really seeing is this gigantic leap into postmodernism where no one believed, and I say that, of course, as a generality, where many, many people do not believe that there are any standards anywhere to be found. There is no truth. It's all relative. That's a long response to your response, Jerry, but I'm agreeing with you that that's a sad state of affairs. And I still don't give up with that. I still seek to lead people into that. And we can easily turn the tables and help them see if we're sharp enough to see where the entrance point is. Okay, it's that time. Well, next week, again, Lord willing, we will look at the debate itself. So come armed with this. Here's the question for you. When Jesus said, "Upon this rock, I will build my church," is that St. Peter? And do you believe that the Pope is the head of the universal Christian church in this world? If y'all didn't hear that, he said, "Is that Randy Pope?" Or no, we have to convince him that he's not the Pope. Okay. All right, let's pray together. Heavenly Father, thank you so very much for your grace. And again, we thank you for these ideas and the historical references and disputations. Would you give us wisdom so that we believe only that which is true, that which is written in your eternal, irrevocable, authoritative word? We love you and pray for your blessing this day. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless.